But during our class on Parsha, we're up to Parshat Ki Teitze. Ki Teitze is quite possibly the richest Parsha in the Torah, because in Ki Teitze you have the most mitzvot. No other Parsha has as many mitzvot as Ki Teitze. So if there's one Parsha you want to know, it's this week's Parsha. You know it well, you've covered 20%, 15% of Torah. Our parasha, one parasha, covers so many mitzvot. Yes, sir.
Is there a reason why the last couple parashas have just been basically just mitzvot?
I don't know. But read the Ramban's introduction as to the purpose of the book of Devarim, and then see if you still have a question. In the beginning of Devarim, Ramban, in the beginning of Devarim, discusses what is the purpose of this book. Okay. So we will run through the parasha quickly, and if we have time, we'll go over it with more depth. But just going through this parasha is a mouthful. So we begin with war. You go to war, so there are multiple types of wars. There's a milchemet mitzvah, where we're obligated to fight the war. So that's the war when Yeshua enters the land of Israel, conquering the land of Israel. Then you have a milchemet reshut, where we've conquered, we're living here, everything's peaceful, everything's fine, we want to expand our territory. So the Torah permits us to do that. So the Torah says, number one, you could take captives. Whereas conquering the land of Israel, the Torah says, you give them a choice before you start the battle, but if they choose to fight you, then you fight to the end. When it comes to outside Israel, you're allowed to take people into captivity. So in ancient times, when they would go to war, when the women thought the war was being lost, they'd get all dressed up and go out to seduce soldiers in the hope that a soldier would marry her. And that way, instead of going into captivity, she would become the wife of a soldier, of the other nation. So this was common practice. The Torah says, you're going out to war, a woman's coming out to seduce you. So the Torah says, you really want her, so you could take her. I'm not going to tell you no, says the Torah, but the Torah alludes repeatedly that the Torah does not recommend doing this. She is not someone who went to Machon Meir and said, I want to study Judaism. She is not someone who has had any change of heart. She is someone who, until 5 minutes ago, was a fabrenta pagan. She was, just before she went out to greet you at war, she offered a sacrifice to Zeus, right? She believed in this a minute ago. Now, in the interest of marrying and going up the ranks, so she's going to say, yes, I'll convert to Judaism. What kind of mother will she be? What kind of a Jew will she be? What kind of home will you have? So the Torah says here, our sages taught us a concept, Dibra Torah keneged yetzer hara, that the Torah sometimes says, I'm not going to tell you not to. I know your desire is so big, I don't recommend it, but I'll tell you if you want to, you can try. It's not recommended. That's another concept. We know there are things the Torah says you must do, there are things the Torah says you must not do, and then there are things that the Torah says, it's going to be hard for you not to do it. I'm not going to tell you not to, but I don't recommend it. So the Torah says, you see a beautiful woman, you want to? Okay, you can take her. And then when you bring her home, so then you have to do a whole process. She'll shave off her hair, and she has to let her nails grow, and she has to take off all the beautiful garments she was wearing and wear ordinary plain garments. And then she has to spend a month in her gear process weeping over the fact that she will no longer be able to be a pagan. Let her weep over her lost family. Let her weep over her lost religion. And then if after that month you want to marry her, you can. So what's the Torah telling us? The Torah is teaching us a rule in fighting the Yetzer Hara. Sometimes the trick is to kick the can down the road. Instead of saying no, the Torah says, you can do it, but here's a few conditions. Bring her home. Don't be like an animal out in the field. Give her the time to cry over the process that she's going to go. Have her shave her head as a sign of mourning. But really, what's going to happen? Suddenly she's without her mascara. Suddenly she's without her makeup. Suddenly she's hairless. Suddenly you don't see her out there smiling and winking at you, but on the contrary, she's sitting in the house crying. She's not wearing the beautiful clothing she wore before. What are you going to tell yourself? I'm crazy. There are beautiful Jewish girls out there. What am I doing here? I didn't know the girl. We might not even talk the same language. So what attracted me to the girl? It's not like you dated her. It's not like you know who she is. It's that her beauty took you. So the Torah says, okay, give her time to take off the beauty and then decide. You want to marry her? You can. I didn't say no. But first, see the person. So in the Torah's doing that, the Torah's goal was to give us a tool to take control of our own desires. One of the most difficult things is to talk to someone who's in love. You can give him a million reasons why it's a bad idea, but he's not listening. So the Torah says, you're enamored by her beauty, you can marry her. The Torah didn't say no. It's like, there are stories like that. There are times like that, I don't know if you'll encounter it as parents, but very often parents see their kids about to make a gruesome error in the person they've chosen. So sometimes, I've had here in the Machon, I had this year, a student came to me and said, I'm ready to marry a girl, an alumni. I said, how many times did you date her? 5 times, she's amazing. I said, you can do what you want, I don't recommend it. And he says to me, you don't understand, everything I prayed for I found in this girl. Why do I have to keep dating her? I said, imagine I have a long white beard, okay? I'm telling you, you date her. I meet about once a month an alumni of ours who tells me after 5 or 6 or 7 dates he's ready to marry the girl. And guess what? I tell them all, go 30 dates. And you know what? Over 50% after they hit date 15 and 18 and 20, change their mind. So she's gotten you and you're very excited over date 5 and 6. If it's Mrs. Wright, it'll only get better as you keep dating. You know what? The guy broke up in the last 2 weeks. We continued dating her, date 15, 16, 17, suddenly discovered, hey, there are real issues here. We can't, and they couldn't overcome them. They tried. So isn't it good they discovered it sooner? But again, this is a story that goes, in the Machon, I have this story about every other month. Student walks in, he's ready to marry the girl after 5 dates. I understand the feeling. I understand the emotion. I dated a girl once, and we ended the date. I didn't even go home. I went to a payphone. I called my father in the United States, and I said, I just met the most amazing girl in the world. You know what? She didn't agree to go out with me a second date. That's it. I thought I met Mrs. Wright, and she notified me, well, you're not Mr. Wright. End the story. So I was wrong, right? The sad part of the story is she's still single, and I'm still trying to set her up. 15 years later. It's very sad. 15, 16 years ago, yeah. It's very sad. I'm trying. I feel bad for her. So the Torah says, do this whole process. This is what's called in Torah, Eishes Yefas Toar. A wife who's beautiful. Right? The Torah is telling you, you didn't marry her for anything else, just for her beauty. And that's a formula for disaster. So, no one's saying you should marry an ugly person. Maybe you should, if you like it. But what the Torah is saying is, if you marry her just for her beauty, that's not going to work. So what happens if at the end of the month you decide, forget it. I don't know what I was thinking. There are nice Jewish girls. Why would I be looking for her? So then you tell yourself, I'll sell her. Torah says, no. You just made her go through this whole process. She agreed. She's leaving paganism. She was weeping over the transition. You can't sell her. Let her go. Goodbye. She's free. She can do whatever she wants. If you would have decided during war, she didn't yet convert. No. She didn't yet convert. The Torah now, David HaMelech, when he learned this, he did not have the tradition we just described. So David HaMelech thought it was a big mitzvah to take women at war, those who were trying to seduce him. So he took the daughter of Talmai, the king of Geshur. She was out there trying to seduce him at war, and he married her. And he had children with her. And from her, he had the gorgeous son, Avshalom. Right? And the gorgeous daughter, Tamar. Right? He had two beautiful children. Tamar was violated by her brother Amnon. And Avshalom led a rebellion against David and tried to kill him and made David... And David was all torn over the rebellion of Avshalom. His Rebbe came to him, Ira Hayairi. And we'll pick up with the story later on after we learn more of the parsha.
Ira Hayairi.
Ira ha'yairi. Correct. We continue. Shimi ben Gera was Shlomo's Rebbe, not David's Rebbe. Okay. Torah describes if a person has two wives, and he loves one, and he hates the other. So the firstborn son has rights. The firstborn son gets double. So you can't say, yeah, but I prefer the other wife's kid. Like Yaakov Avinu says, I prefer Yosef. He's my firstborn from Rachel. So I'm going to give him double instead of giving Reuven. You're not supposed to do that. When we get to the parsha, we'll have to discuss it. The Rishonim discussed, was it okay what Yaakov Avinu did with Yosef? The Torah says he has to make known his firstborn son from the wife he hates. And he gets double. From here we learn halacha. Yakir, you make him known. From here the Torah actually gave license to a parent to declare, this is my son, this is my firstborn son. Why are you believed? You have two witnesses. Does anyone know? You're believed. The Torah says, Yakir, Yakirenu Lacherim. You could make it known who your son is and who has rights. There have been famous stories, right? Infamous stories about all kinds of people who showed up and said, so-and-so is my dad, right? I heard there's someone running around saying Barack Obama's his dad, right? No, or he's Barack Obama's brother. Something like that, right? There are all kinds of stories. Well, who's believed? Who knows? So the Torah says the father has a right to declare a person his child, etc. Okay, and then the Torah describes a rebellious son, a kid who between the age of, at a young age, he's reaching maturity, and within a half a year, he gets warned, he steals money from his parents, he drinks wine before it's even settled, he eats his meat raw, he's becoming a part of the gangsters in town, and within 6 months, his parents warned him, his parents are of equal height, they both have the same voice, and in spite of the warning, he continues his evil ways, so he gets a death penalty. So the Talmud says it never happened. There's never a kid who actually got stoned like this, but the Torah is teaching us a concept that sometimes you have to be concerned what path is a kid on, where is he headed to? And the Torah is teaching us a concept in education that you want to educate properly, you have to have the same voice. What does that mean? A woman has a deep bass voice? No, that's not what it means. It means the kid has to hear a consistent message. There are those kids that when the dad is home, he says, no TV. And then he goes out to work and the mom says, what channel would you like? Right, the kid gets contradictions. Torah says you want education to succeed, there has to be consistency. I'll get to you in a minute. So, Chazal say these three mitzvot are juxtaposed because they're telling us a theme. The guy marries a woman who wasn't interested in the religion and wasn't really interested in marrying him. Then he'll end up having a wife who he hates. And then he'll end up having children who go down a very different path than the way of the Torah. So this is a theme. What we learn from the theme is the importance of verifying as we're dating the values of the person we're dating. Sometimes people tell me, I'm dating the girl, it seems good, but she doesn't want to cover her hair when we'll get married. And I say, what about other mitzvot? How does she decide what yes, what no? Very often a girl will say, there are certain things I'm just not going to do. And I say, there are two questions here. How observant we are, we all have our strengths and our weaknesses. But what's our modus operandi? How do I decide what yes and what no? Am I picking and choosing? Or do I say, look, I'm growing. This is too hard for me. I'll get there one day. Or do I say, no. These mitzvahs have nothing to do with me. So then if I'm picking and choosing, what am I going to choose tomorrow? The Torah says, when you're looking for a mate, be careful about where her values are. And then the Torah says it can easily happen that a person has a wife who he really doesn't like, because their values are so far apart. Part of what we're checking out when we're getting married is, what do we believe in? Where do we want to go to? What are we aspiring to? And finally, it affects the kids' education. The kids, if they look at their mom and dad, it's very hard to live with a contradiction. In a child's mind, Abba's always right, Ima's always right. So if Abba and Ima give a consistent message, I can live peacefully. If they give me a disjointed message, then I'm not sure what I'm supposed to do. Okay, yes, sir.
Is Ben Sarir Marir not an analogy for the Jewish people and God kind of sending them out?
Nope. Rav Tashani. The Torah says yes. Right. We have to go. There's a whole chapter called Ben Sorer Moreh, and it goes into all the details, and each one is a different theme about how to educate kids. The idea is generally you have to give an equal message. Okay, we move forward. Torah says if a person gets a death penalty, he gets hung. We're talking about if he gets stoned, right? Now, in order to get the death penalty in Judaism, a guy has to be really wicked because there have to be two witnesses present. And just before he does whatever he does, they tell him, you know, if you do this, you're going to get the death penalty. It says in the Torah not to do it. So why would a person do that? So I always say the scene you have to imagine is a story of, let's say, a married woman. And a group of gangsters come in and they tie her up. And they tie up all the people in the house. And they say, we're going to kill all of you. And the people in the house say, well, if you violate her, then you're going to get the death penalty because she's a married woman. And they say, be quiet. And then they go ahead and do it. Now, you can imagine such a scene, right? When a person imagines that the witnesses are never going to be able to testify, or the witnesses are never going to get to court, then even if the witnesses just told him, you know, you're going to get the death penalty, that's prohibited, then they might go ahead and do whatever they were going to do. Well, then they're going to get the death penalty. The idea of the death penalty in Judaism is you had a warning by two witnesses before you did it that the act was punishable by the death penalty. Now, it could be the guy thought, I'd never get caught. But bottom line, the only time a person gets a death penalty is when they did something on purpose, knowing that it was punishable with the death penalty.
It's also from Shemayim or from the...
No, Shemayim is a different deal. Death at the hands of heaven, God judges a person. That's a different question. But the death penalty at the hands of the court is only when a person purposely did something, knowing full well it was punishable with death.
So they didn't have to be told it, if they already knew it without being told it.
That's a good question. The Talmud says we do tell them, because we're always concerned. Maybe they forgot a second before they did it.
But in case there's nobody there, or like the victims don't tell them, then that's
That's a big discussion in Talmud.
Okay.
It's not so clear that you can administer the death penalty. The courts might put him in jail, the courts might do other things. But technically the death penalty, we assume, is when they've had warning just before committing the crime.
The scenario you just gave, for example, it's impossible to give them a death penalty.
Why?
If
they're dead. But the police broke into the house an hour later. The SWAT team came in and they caught him. There are stories like that. Okay, so when a person gets stoned, he gets hung. Torah says...
And they will never know if the witnesses said it before. He will say, no, he will tell me.
The witnesses are believed to say, we gave him warning.
You killed them.
If they're dead, they're dead. We're talking about where they're not dead. I'm saying there can be instances where it happens.
When they're supposed to get skila, they get hung?
Yes. After skila, we hang the body.
You hang them already dead.
Correct.
To show
is, that
where,
is that also with Fennec and Trefah?
No, I said skila.
For warning?
A person who was stoned will then have his body hung. So we have a rule. When a person is killed by the sword, we bury the sword with the body. When a person is hung, we bury the string with the body. Torah says when you hang a person, don't leave it there overnight. We're not looking to defile the body. And that's why in Talmudic times, in days of the Mishnah, when they still implemented these punishments, so then they would prepare the body just before nightfall, and then they'd hang him a minute before sunset. Hang him. He'd hang for 2 seconds, and then they take him down. Because our approach is we're going to do whatever we have to do in the best possible way that where we fulfilled what the Torah commanded, but we were as kind as possible to the person who was executed, even though he was executed. We bury the string with him. People shouldn't say, oh, that's the string Charles was hanging on. We bury it with him.
And
so,
is the reason for hanging the body after it's already been stoned to keep people from committing the same crime? So,
I don't know.
To show.
I don't know why the Torah said it. I don't know. I don't know what the logic behind it is. I don't know. We move forward. So the Torah says, if you see your friend's lost object, lost animal, bring it back. We have a mitzvah, Shavat Aveda. So this mitzvah has interesting applications in our day, but I want to take a step back before we go there. The death penalty was supposed to be a deterrent. If the court saw, as they did in the Second Temple period, that people were transgressing the Torah right and left, the courts imposed an exile on themselves, and they said, we're not administering the death penalty anymore, because the purpose isn't to be killing all the sinners. The purpose is that people won't sin. The Torah's intention was, if it happens once in 70 years, that you have to give the death penalty, so then people will hear about it, and they won't do it again. Once the court saw that people were transgressing openly, so they said no more death penalty. The purpose here is not to kill the sinner as much as to teach the people that it shouldn't be done. So when it's a once in a generation, that once in 70 years you hear about something happening, so the courts react, the people were on that moral level, so that's a way of retaining the level. But once the court saw things were deteriorating, they said, forget it, we're not giving the death penalty anymore. Yes?
Does that apply also to the show's dream? That motion posed after a slough cut?
Does what apply?
Did they also cancel the show dream?
That was a one-time thing, the show dream. It wasn't every week. It was only that Shabbos. That's a different thing.
They're not connected?
Totally different show dream, yeah. Okay. We move forward. So we have a mitzvah of returning lost objects. So you could spend your whole life being a do-gooder. You find a pen on the floor. Who lost this pen? You find a tissue on the floor. Did anyone drop a tissue? So the balance here is very difficult. We say that today, where we don't, no one loses sleep over an ordinary pen. You don't have to waste your time looking for the one who lost the pen. Don't take it and pocket it, because maybe the guy's coming back and taking it. But if you see a pen on the floor on a bus or something, you could just say, did anyone lose it? If you find something of value, then you do have to announce it. You have to find ways to put up signs and find out who lost that object. But if it's something that's not of value, you find keys. So for most people, their keys are very valuable to them. Replacing them is very hard. So you're supposed to put up signs for 30 days. You put up signs around the place where you found it, and you say, I found something, and then you leave a way of contacting you. Now, if you don't know who lost it, if you know it's your neighbor's dog, so you bring them home. But if it's something that you don't know who lost it, so you bring it home to your house, and you put up signs. So you found a wallet. A wallet happened to have 3,000 shekel in it. So you put up a sign, I found something. So a guy walks over to you and he says, gee, I was wondering if perhaps that thing had money in it. And you say, yes, it did. And he says, so I lost it. So you give it back to him and he pockets 3,000 shekel. That's not so smart. So the Torah says, seek him out. Till your brother comes to seek him out from you, from there we derive, you seek him out in as much that when he shows up, you interview him. You say, what'd you lose? And he says, something with money. And you say, what? And he has to give you a sign. He has to give you a very distinct sign, what's called in halacha a siman, a sign that identifies this is his. You know, if he says, I lost my car key, you say, where's the car? We'll see if the key fits. He has to have a good reason, right? But if he's going to take that key and he figures, I know all the members of the shul, there are 30 members in shul, I'm going to come and collect the car key, and then every Matzei Shabbos I'll go around and check all the cars. Eventually I'll find the one. You're not allowed to give it back to him. There has to be a sign. Now, money ordinarily does not have a sign. You find money, you could pocket it. There are a few exceptions. If you find money in a specific place, I once showed up to shul, and I suddenly realized I had a 200 shekel bill in my pocket. Shabbos is settling in, right? I got 20 minutes to Shabbos. So I took the 20 shekel bill, and I slipped it under the tablecloth in shul, under where I had my sperm piled up underneath. I put the 200 shekel bill. Okay, right after Shabbos, I give a class, so I couldn't go collect it. And as I'm giving the class, I see people are folding up the tablecloths. So I'm thinking, oh, I hope they don't fold the tablecloth I sat by. And I see the kid who went there and folded up the tablecloth where I was sitting. So I come back to my place, and the 200 shekel bill is gone. Now, technically, you find a 200 shekel bill on the floor. You find a 200 shekel bill somewhere where anyone could have dropped it. It's yours. Who knows who dropped it? Anyone could say I dropped it. There's no proof the money is yours. And even if you write your name on it, I'll write my name on 50 bills, and then I'll pay all my bills with it. And then eventually, whenever it'll drop, right, I'll get it back. It'll have my name on it. So writing your name doesn't help, because maybe you used that bill to pay someone. So you wrote your name. It was once yours. That doesn't mean you're the one who lost it, right? So the bill is gone. What do? The kid's a friend of mine. So I didn't want to put him on the spot. I went and I opened up all the tablecloths. Figured maybe it's there in the tablecloths. Maybe he folded it up and he didn't see it. It's not there. So Baruch Hashem, it did show up. It had gotten caught as he was folding it. It had gotten caught in one of the books. But I said to myself, if he found it, if let's say he took off the books off the table, picked up the tablecloth to fold it, finished folding the tablecloth and saw a 200 shekel bill on the floor, technically he'd be right in taking it, because he didn't know that I put it in a specific place where I had it hidden till after Shabbos. What he sees is a 200 shekel bill on the floor. Well, you see a 200 shekel bill on the floor, no one can claim it's theirs. How do you know whose it is? Now, if you're having a ride, right? You have a car, you've given four people a ride to a wedding. After they leave the car, you see a 200 shekel bill on the seat. So you could be a nice guy and call the people who you gave a ride to and say, you know, someone did one of you drop a 200 shekel bill? And if one of you tells you, yes, I did, it's okay. You could give it back to him. It's a nice thing to do. If you move into an apartment, I have a friend who he used to collect a lot of money. He had a lot of apartments he would rent out, so he had a lot of cash in his apartment. So what would he do with his cash? He'd roll it up, put it in a sock, in a rolled up sock, and toss it on the top shelf of where he had his wardrobe. When he moved out of the apartment, he was in a rush. He collected his rolled up socks, and a month later, he's counting his socks, and he realizes he left one in the wardrobe on top of the shelf. So there's a sock there with like $10,000. So he calls back the next tenant, and he says, you know, I used to have socks filled with cash in the wardrobe on the top shelf. And he hears the guy go, really? That's so interesting. And he goes, I think I left one on that top shelf. And the guy goes, that's interesting. I'll go look. And then the guy says, how do I know it's yours? So he says, what do you mean? Who else put a sock with $10,000 up there? And the guy was a real slimeball. He said, well, I have no way of knowing it's yours. I'm very sorry. And he kept the money. It's true that money ordinarily is something that doesn't have a sign. But rolled up money in a sock, well, that he's put it in a unique wallet, right? He's put it in a unique place. There's a unique amount. Before
how else would he
know? Right. I think so. Right? I think he should have given it back, right? So we have a big mitzvah called the Shavat Aveda. Now, the Torah says you can't... I'm sorry, I didn't hear. No, he had moved out of the country. It was he cared about it, but he couldn't deal with it because he wasn't living in that country anymore. And the guy could have just denied it. It's not like he recorded the conversation. The guy could have said, I don't know what you're talking about. What, $10,000? I don't know.
Huh? I would have just said I lost a sock.
Okay, we move on. The Torah says it doesn't matter if it's an animal or a garment. You have a mitzvah to give it back. Now, here's a tip to the wise. You own things, right? You own sweaters, you own jackets, you own things. And here in the Machon, even your garments that you launder. Get a permanent marker. It costs you 6-7 shekel. Write your name. Because you use the public laundry machine. And sometimes someone comes, you're in the middle of a class, they take out your laundry, they put it on the side, you come and collect it, and you miss a shirt, you miss a sock. If you have your name on it, you can collect it. So you have a coat. Sometimes you forget a coat. You visit someone, you forget your coat there. You go to a different shul. Today, I was on my way here, I left my helmet, my bicycle helmet, on the bus. So if you have your name on things, a name and a telephone number, they can get back to you. Again, in the Machon, I would write my name on everything. You have books. I have a rule at home. I learned from my father. You buy a new book, it doesn't leave the house till it has your name on it. Because people forget books. They lose books. it's a good idea. Help people do Hashavat Avedah. Write your name in things. Okay, so the Torah says you're not allowed to ignore it. Chazal say, the Torah worded it twice. It says, you see your neighbor's lost object, you'll ignore it? No, give it back. You're not supposed to ignore it. So Talmud says, why did it first word it as, you'll ignore it? And a question mark? To tell you that sometimes you should read it as a sentence. You see your friend's lost object, you'll ignore it. When should you ignore it? If it's beneath your dignity to deal with it. I was once on a bus, and the guy sitting next to me was reading a magazine. He got off the bus. I knew the guy. But the magazine was a magazine I wouldn't hold in my hands. I'm not saying real filthy, but it was like, a modern magazine, which has clean stuff and not clean stuff. So I wouldn't want to be caught dead with that in my hand. So now I have a mitzvah to run after him and say, here. I have a mitzvah to take it off the bus with me and call him up. No. When the lost object is something that's beneath your dignity to deal with, you don't have a mitzvah, Shavas Aveda. You don't have the mitzvah. We move on. Torah says a man may not wear women's clothing. So the theme is there were men who would find ways to mix with women by wearing women's clothing. I remember one Purim, we were dancing, and our Rosh Hashiva was dancing in the middle of the dance floor, and a guy came in dressed up, a few guys came in, and they danced with him. And then they went out to a waiting limo, and we discovered it was a group of girls that wanted to trick the Rosh Hashiva. So they came in dressed up as guys, and they danced with the Rosh Hashiva. And then they ran out to their waiting limo. Okay, but the Torah says you're not allowed to get dressed up, and the idea is because that's a way of breaking modesty. So that's one concept.
Is it okay if women dress up as men?
No, and this applies to many things. People aren't aware of this. You're not supposed to shave your arms. It's a female thing to do. Shave your arms. Shave your armpits. That's something that women do. Shave their legs. Men are not supposed to do that.
That will mix with modesty.
Correct.
Issues.
I said the general theme, but the technical halacha is, if you live in a place where men wear earrings, so okay, you could wear an earring. It's not a recommended thing to do, but technically, it's not biblically prohibited. If you live in a place where men who are married wear a wedding ring, you could wear a ring. But if you live in a place where men don't, so if you're going to wear it, you're wearing women's clothing, then you can't wear a ring. What about wearing pants? If where you live, the norm is in that country, in that territory, that women wear pants, so it might be less modest than wearing a skirt. But it's not the biblical prohibition of a woman's not allowed to wear men's clothing. If you live in Scotland, then men wear kilts, right? So you're not going to say, hey, stop dressing like a woman, right? If that's how men dress. So the rule is you're not supposed to wear clothing that are for the opposite gender. And this even includes standing in front of the mirror for a long time doing your hair. That's a woman thing to do. You want to comb your hair, comb your hair. You want to stand there and get every hair right. Imagine I'm here, yeah? And my son was sitting on my head this morning, and he says, Abba, we see a lot of your head. I said, that's a nice way to say you're balding. Thank you. I said to him, are you jealous? Because your head I never saw. I only see here. Okay, back to our parsha. So you're not supposed to, a man is not supposed to wear a woman's clothing. A woman is not supposed to wear man's clothing. What if it's cross-gender, right? You can have a black coat that's good for men and good for women. Okay, so that's fine. We have a mitzvah of Kan Tzipor. You're walking in your yard. You're walking outside, and you see a bird, and the bird has eggs, and you want the eggs. So I'll just tell you that birds' nests very often have lice. You got to think about whether you want to tackle that. But you have a mitzvah. If you want to take the babies or the chicks or the eggs, then you have to shoo away the mother. She shouldn't stand there witnessing as you collect her babies or her eggs. And even if she keeps flying back, you keep shooing her away. So this is a mitzvah that has all kinds of Kabbalistic deeper meanings. We don't really understand why this mitzvah is so important. It's a mitzvah, fine. The Torah gives us many mitzvahs about compassion. This mitzvah specifically has a lot written about it. If we have time at the end of class, remind me, we'll come back to this mitzvah. There's a lot to discuss about it. The Torah says you build a new house. So make sure to have a ma'akeh. Make sure to have some kind of fence. You don't end up falling off the roof. So this comes up often. First of all, people sometimes are tempted to make a sukkah on the roof. That's great. Do you have a ma'akeh? In Israel, you do not legally have to have anything preventing people from falling out of a window. right? Now, depending on the height of the window, that could be very dangerous. So the halacha says a makeh has to be this high. Doesn't that mean your windows are very often going to be high enough that technically, halachically, you're not obligated? It doesn't fall under the category that you need a makeh, but it still might be smart. The Torah says, "Lo tasim damim beveitecha." You're not allowed to have something in your house that is a danger to people. So from here we learn you're not allowed to retain a ladder in your house that you know that that ladder, whoever climbs on it, will fall. You're not allowed to have a vicious dog in your house that doesn't have a very clear leash, because the scare that you can make to people. I used to have a neighbor like this. Every night I got scared. Every night I'd come home in the dark and I'd hear his dog growling and running at me, and I'd always pray, I hope the chain's on, I hope the chain's on, right? So it made me a very religious person. But that's against halacha. If you have a dog that scares people, there has to be a clear chain on him that no one gets scared from him, that they see that he can't threaten them. So the Torah says, "Lo tasim damim beveitecha." There's a biblical mitzvah. You're not allowed to leave something that can cause bloodshed in your home. Obviously, you're allowed to have sharp knives at home, but you're not allowed to leave them in a place where people can get hurt from them. Okay, so let's see a few examples of this. I wanted to leave the house. I was rushing to yeshiva, and I saw the socket had come out of the wall. So I stopped, and I said, okay, I told my wife, I'm not leaving. My wife said, what do you mean? You were in a rush a minute ago. I said, right, but I'm not allowed to leave. There's a socket that's coming out of the wall. I have to fix it. Because chas v'chalila, if someone sticks their hand in there, you know, little kids, everything's interesting to them. So then that's a danger. So you're not allowed to leave your house in a way that there's something dangerous in the house. So I have to fix the socket. I'm not going anywhere. Went and got the tools, shut the fuse, put the electric piece back in, right? The socket back in. And then I could leave. So this is a biblical commandment. You can't leave something that's a danger lying around the house. Okay, next commandment. Someone had their hand up? No. Okay, yes.
What about weapons?
So that depends. There are many details. Let's go one at a time. Just like I'm allowed to have a sharp knife at home, I'm allowed to have a gun. But am I allowed to leave the gun loaded? I'm not talking about the law that prohibits it. I'm talking about common sense and the danger. So let me explain. I have a lot of friends that own guns. And whoever asks me, I say, I recommend not owning a gun. Why? Because most people will forget the gun somewhere, sometime. It's very common that people forget their guns places. Another issue, you load a gun. So in order for a gun to shoot, ordinarily you have the bullets in the handle of the gun or in the revolver, and whatever that thing is called. And in order for the gun to shoot, so you have to cock the gun. You pull back the head of the gun. When you cock the gun, so a bullet goes into the chamber. Now, once you've done that, basically what happens is the hammer of the gun is pulled back. Right? You cocked the gun, a bullet went into the chamber, and now the hammer is here. And what happens if the gun gets knocked? So the hammer can be released, and boom, that's it. A bullet went out. So I think that if people ask, can I own a gun in the house? Well, can you be safe? Most people will sometimes forget it in the bathroom. It's very hard to hold a gun in your belt all the time. So at some point you put it down when you go to the restroom. Did you forget it there? Did you endanger people's lives? So you'll say, it wasn't loaded. Yeah, but you know what? My son explained to me how to load a gun. How does he know? It's like he taught me what an iPhone was. How do these little kids know? They know. So technically you can't say it's prohibited to own a weapon. We all own dangerous things. You have to ask yourself, A, are you allowed to carry it around loaded? So there can be scenarios. We had a rabbi here who used to have shootouts in his house. The Arabs used to literally shoot into his house. They'd get up in the morning sometimes with bullets flying through the window.
Where was this? Which neighborhood?
This was in East Jerusalem. So you're going to tell a guy like that he shouldn't sleep with a loaded gun? The flip side is, you're going to sleep with a loaded gun? What happens if one of the kids just touches it? You know, I have a story. I once went into the...
Under your mattress.
The question is, does it help you if it's under your mattress? you know, down the block from me is a yeshuv called Michmas. In Michmas, so terrorists walked in the middle of the night and they murdered Dani. There's Mitzpe Dani. I don't remember his last name. Dani was murdered in the middle of the night. So Dani's neighbor, it's a relative of mine, he told me that ever since then, he slept with a gun under his bed, under his pillow. So one night, he hears footsteps approaching his bed. And in a split second, his gun was out and cocked and in his wife's face. And he's very lucky he didn't kill her. She was tiptoeing not to wake him. And they were all living in panic. His next door neighbor had just been murdered in the middle of the night in his sleep. So when he heard tiptoeing next to his bed, in a second his wife had a cocked gun in her face. It's a tough question. But I don't think you could say, I don't think anyone can say that you're not allowed to own a gun. I'm saying we own knives. You can own it. You have to be very conscious of, are you going to be responsible with it? Okay, we move on to, and again, my recommendation for most people is don't do it. Most people are not.
The website is the amount of casualties are which fall in Europe. And when the people were allowed to carry guns, like people here in Israel, it wasn't that much.
So I think the difference here is that. In Israel, people are trained on how to carry weapons. The people that carry guns, no, they do the army. It's not just you go to the to short training.
Same conditions. I'm talking about the same conditions, but what are the demand conditions?
Okay, no. So I'm saying even though the demand is low, if you want to take out a gun in Israel, all you need is you have to have approval from your regular doctor, and today they added they have to undergo psychiatric evaluation, and you have to show a good reason why you need the gun. And then you go to a shooting range, they give you a 25-minute course, and you could have a gun. You shoot 50 bullets, and you could own a gun. I'm saying it's not so hard here.
No.
The reason, to my mind, why things, Baruch Hashem, are relatively safe here is that most of the people don't get a gun from that minimal amount. They undergo 3 years of army or a year and a half of army training. That's a big difference. People don't play games, and we have very tough laws here. If you're arguing with someone in the street, you just put your hand on the gun, you go to prison and you lose your weapon. Meaning you're not allowed to threaten with it. Even if you just put your hand there, you didn't pull it out, you didn't say you're doing anything with it. You had an itch on your side, right? But you touched the gun. During an argument, he can put you in jail. You can lose it, you lose the gun, you lose the license, and you go to jail. So there are very tough laws, which are very good. Okay, we move on. So we have a mitzvah of kelayim, right? So we have a mitzvah that we're not supposed to plant different plants together where we're crossbreeding. So this... Bezrat Hashem, many of you will live in places where you can grow many things in your yard. So this comes up. How far do I have to separate between my grapevines and my tomato patch? Those are questions in the laws of Kilayim. We move on. You're not supposed to use two different animals when plowing a field. A donkey and an ox. The poor donkey is going to really be pained. The ox is working so, has so much more strength than the donkey. But it doesn't matter. The idea is you're not supposed to use two species, even if one's behind pushing the cart and the other one's in the front. Doesn't matter. You're not supposed to use two species when drawing a cart. Next, we have the mitzvah of shatnez. I showed you guys the shatnez laboratory on Thursday night. We have a mitzvah. We should not wear clothing that have wool and linen mixed together. So the idea is that wool and linen represent the First World War, the first act of hatred in the world, right? Cain and Abel. Cain was growing linen, he was growing flax, he was growing fruits. Hevel was growing sheep and their wool. Cain brought an offering of flax. Hevel brought an offering of sheep. Hashem says these two represent the first murder, the first fight in world history, the first hatred and jealousy. Don't mix them in your garments. Today, scientifically, they have shown that wool and linen together create sparks. This is a phenomenal thing I heard from sparks. Wool and linen together, in NASA, they have a rule that they cannot have in the lining of the electric components of the spaceship. So very often when you make electric wiring, our engineer, you can check this out. When you have electric wiring, so around the wiring, we very often put a material. What material do you put? So you can put, I don't know if they're putting wool or linen, but whichever one they're using, you're not allowed to have the other component there. There's like, they go through all the things because they discovered scientifically that wool and linen together cause these micro sparks to happen. Give us real information, Mr. Engineer. The next class you show up, give us the scientific side of it. But Dave, the Torah just says it. The Torah says no wearing wool and linen together. We have a mitzvah of tzitzis. Okay, what's a mitzvah tzitzis? So this past Friday, we discussed a little bit how you make tzitzit. If you wear a garment that has at least four corners, so then you have to put tzitzit, special strings that are made for the sake of the mitzvah, and a third of it we wrap and tie and wrap and tie and wrap and tie, and then the rest of it hangs out as strings. If we have time, we'll get back and revisit that mitzvah. What's the idea behind it? So that's a mitzvah of tzitzit. Okay. Who wants to review what we learned so far? Wait, guys, summarize for me. We did a bunch of mitzvah so far. Tell me what we do so far. Hated wife, before. Yeah.
Then we went to the wicked kids. Then we went
hanging. We discussed hanging.
Hanging, bury the rope, you bury the sword.
Male and female clothing.
Male and female clothing. Returning a lost object.
And the birds, the bird and the egg.
The bird, okay. What else?
We're supposed to go back on that.
Yeah, we're not yet there, yeah. What?
Very naughty boy.
Okay. When you build a new house, not to leave something that's dangerous, to put a wall, to put some kind of fence on the roof. no crossbreeding. No. But you, what you are allowed to do is, you're allowed to put two different animals in a pen so that they will mate. So long as you don't physically mate them. You don't insert one into the other. The fact that you put them in a corral together and they will mate, that's permissible. Huh. Yes?
Like two kinds of goats.
So in Halacha we discuss when. We have a whole tractate called Kilayim, which discusses when is it considered two species and when not. What defines it as two species?
So why is it allowed with animals but not plants?
Why is what allowed with... You're not crossbreeding with animals. You're not being active. They're doing it.
But I mean, with the plants also, like if you just put them close enough together.
No, so that's called you crossbred the plants. But you are allowed to buy the fruits that are crossbred. Mm-hmm. So half the fruits we have today are crossbred. Nectarine.
And why is that though? I mean, why is it a negative mitzvah to not be allowed to crossbreed plants?
I can hypothesize about making aberrations in nature, but that would be my hypothesis. If we're looking, so we should look in the Sefer HaChinuch later, okay? Remind me. Okay. Maybe Thursday night we'll open up Sefer HaChinuch and we'll see. That's a concise book, right? There's the more in-depth book. Okay. Okay, next story. Our next story is called Motzi Shemra. A guy gets married. And in ancient times when you'd get married, so the marriage had two steps. Number one, you'd give her the ring, the way we do today. And then you'd wait a year, and then you'd do the actual chuppah and bring her home. So once she gets the ring, legally you're married. Right, we make a blessing over the kiddushin, over the first step of marriage, which says we thank Hashem for giving us that holiness, that there's fidelity. That once you're married, that's it. She's not allowed to be with anyone else. So what happens is they do kiddushin. He gives her the ring, and a year later they get married, and they go home after the wedding, and he finds out she's not a virgin. He says. He starts doing his homework and he comes back and he says, I hear that in the past year, ever since we really got married a year ago, ever since step one, she cheated on me. So the Torah says, if we can prove that he's a liar, so there's a specific punishment to him. Imagine a guy who after the first night decides I've had it with this girl. So he makes up the story. So the Torah says the courts verify it, and if it turns out he's lied, so then he gets punished. He has a special tax he has to pay, a very big tax, and he gets punished by the courts, and he gets taxed that he can never divorce her his whole life. If he had wanted to have a legitimate divorce and pay up what he owes her, that he could have done. But if he he made up a story, so then...
Pay the money to her?
Depends on the age, but generally to her father. We're talking about a young girl. We're talking about a girl who's 12 that got married, 12 and a half.
Nara?
Yeah. Here we learn the concept of Motzi Shemra. We keep learning about Lashon Hara. Lashon Hara is the truth. Motzi Shemra is you spread a bad reputation about someone. That's called Motzi Shemra.
And if she's a virgin, I mean not a virgin, like from something she's done before the engagement, is that anything bad or not?
So then the only thing is, he can argue, you lied to me, you misled me.
I mean,
we got married under false pretenses. If she's honest about it, so then that's fine. When we write a ksuba, though, the ksuba says, this virgin, and the ksuba entitles her to double the amount because this is the first guy she's with. If she's not a virgin, then you should tell the rabbi who's officiating the wedding. Now, chozeret b'tshuva, our assumption is she's not a virgin. Unless she was chozeret b'tshuva at a very young age. Today, unfortunately, the way the world goes, the assumption is that a person who has either converted or done chazerah b'tshuva at a later age, they're not a virgin. That's a given. If someone's dating a chozeret b'tshuva and they're not aware of that, they're being gullible. Now, it's true, there are a lot of gullible people. A person who grows up in a Jewish society is not expecting that. He's not even thinking in terms of that. But no, that's so then we just try to be upfront about it. If we touched on this, I will tell you my recommendation is that before a couple get engaged, they do a full disclosure of their medical records, and they ensure that they're not going into any surprises, that there are no STDs, that there's no HIV, that there's no hepatitis, that there's no herpes. You know, a person should, if a person's chozer b'tshuva, they should check themselves out, and they should, if they're marrying a chozer b'tshuva, so then I recommend you make sure that things are the way we assume they are. And sometimes I'm the bad guy. Sometimes I tell a student of ours, hey, buddy, go get yourself checked before you get engaged. Don't go doing this irresponsibly. Okay, we move forward. What happens if a man commits adultery? So the adulterer and the adulteress, if there were witnesses, if someone warned them beforehand, as we described, they can even get the death penalty. What happens, we'll touch on this because it's relevant. People are sometimes very zealous. A woman comes home and her husband says, why did you get back so late from work? And she says, there was a lot of work. You wouldn't imagine. It's tax season. We were working till 1 in the morning. I sent you an SMS. You didn't get it? He says, no. She says, that's funny. I thought I sent it. And then she shows him. She says, oh, you see, I didn't hit the send button. And then he says, who was at the workplace with you? She says, Bob. We were both working on it. He says, you were with Bob till 1 o'clock in the morning in the office? She says, oh my gosh, I forgot. It's Yichud. You're right. I shouldn't have been there all alone with him in the office. Now the husband says, how do I know what went on? So she says, I'm telling you, nothing happened. Halacha says, unless you really know something happened, nothing happened. There's a famous story, Rabbi Akiva Eiger was the chief rabbi, and most of Europe listened to him. So a man, there was talk about a man and his neighbor, that he and she were committing adultery. So one morning, a guy looks out his house, and he sees that the woman, her front door opens a crack, and her neighbor from across the street peeks out the door, looks to the left, looks to the right, sees that no one's looking, and makes a dash across the street to his own house in his pajamas. So they came to Rabbi Akiva Eiger and they said, this is what we know. People have been talking that when this woman's husband is out on business trips, she's cheating with the neighbor across the street. Is he allowed to stay married to her? So the halacha is, the Talmud says, that you punish a person for doing things that are questionable. But you don't go around saying she committed adultery. You have no idea what happened. Maybe he went to get a bag of milk and he was scared because everyone was talking about him. You don't know. You have no witnesses. You don't know what happened. Bottom line, her children are her children. She's kosher to continue living with her husband. If we have testimony that, you know, if we have if the husband has reason to know that his wife cheated on him, he's not allowed to stay married to her. He must get divorced. But if he doesn't know, so he doesn't.
But isn't that reason to know? Like,
you don't know. All you know is that the guy did something that's very suspicious. You don't know. Yes.
Didn't we say at some point the reason why Sota is in Shulchan Aruch is that when the husband first becomes suspicious, that is the beginning stages of Sota? So was that on the basis that it's a acceptable suspicion or just any suspicion?
Two opinions in Talmud. First page of Tractate Sota. Back to our parsha. So, in general, couples have to work on trust, and couples shouldn't be suspect all the time, and couples should retain the laws of Yichud. But we do have this law that if a person, God forbid, knows that his wife cheated with someone else, they have to get divorced. There's no...
In that situation, do the kids, I mean, not in that exact situation, but if they could prove that the wife cheated, then the kids aren't the mothers anymore?
They might be the mothers, they're not the fathers.
The father?
That was a story, right? That was a story under Rav Herzog, that a couple got divorced, and the wife was suing the husband for child support, and the husband said, I'm not paying, it's not my kid. And the wife said, yes, it is. And he said, then let's do blood tests. And they did blood tests, and he proved that it wasn't his kid. So the halacha says, if a blood test proves it, a blood test proves it. Finished. I mean, these are unfortunate things. I'm saying, we build a house. These things are, a person should rather die than do this. You know, they put a gun to a person's head, and they say, commit adultery or we'll shoot you. He has to say, shoot me, I'm not doing it. He's not allowed to do it. I mean, we're talking about it as though, yeah, this happens. No, this does not happen. A person has to give up his life rather than do this. We move on. The Torah says, what happens if a girl, as we described, she got her wedding ring, now they're waiting the year to do the chuppah, to do the actual wedding, the final stage of the wedding, and at that time, a man violates her. So it says they both get the death penalty. She'll say, he did it. It was against my will. And we'll ask, you're in the middle of the city. Why didn't you yell? See, if she says, he pulled out a gun on me, I couldn't yell. Okay. But if she could have yelled, so we say, there were people around. What do you mean it was against your will? But what happens if it's out in the field? So then we say, she's completely absolved. She can marry the guy. She did nothing wrong. On the contrary, the man will get the death penalty, or he'll have to pay a tax, depending on what happened. But if she was engaged, so he'll get the death penalty, because we said she's a married woman already from that point onward. What? That's still, we say what she did was wrong, she shouldn't have done it, but she was still violated, it's against her will. And from here, we learn the concept that onus rachmana patre. Ones means rape, ones means something that's done against my ability. So from here, the Torah says you don't hold it against the girl for what she did. It was against her will. Here we learn, let's say you had no choice. There can be a million scenarios. A guy grew up and his parents never taught him what it means to be a Jew. So he grows up and he's eating non-kosher and he's turning on the light switch on Shabbos, and then he comes to Machon Meir and he says, oh my gosh, what did I do these 20 years? So the Torah says, God doesn't punish you for things that were beyond your control. Here, this is the source for that concept, that anus, when things are beyond my control, I couldn't have done any better, so then God doesn't hold it against me. The Torah says, don't punish the girl. It's just like murder. Just like if a guy gets up and murders someone else, you don't say, why'd you get murdered for? What could I have done? The same thing the girl says, what could I have done? So that's why here we have this concept of ones. Things that are beyond my control, I'm not held accountable for. This is a very important concept, because very often we beat ourselves up over things that are really beyond our control. I couldn't have done better. I had no way of knowing. If I could have done better, I have to make amends. But if I couldn't, I couldn't. Yes, sir.
Do we find the knas also for other instances of motzi shtekra? Between a guy and his friend, a guy and...
Not defined by Torah. There can be, I mean, rabbis might, but not defined by Torah. The Torah says, what happens if a guy violates a girl against her will? So then he, and she wasn't engaged, she wasn't married. So he pays the tax, and she has a right to force him to marry her for life. She has a right. It's up to her if she wants to. But if she wants to, she's no longer a virgin. He violated her.
Right, but... Okay.
Why would she want to do that?
Very often she'd want to do that. Very often. There can be instances where he was her best friend. There can be instances where she would have agreed, like Tamar said to Amnon, let's do it normally. Don't force me now. Let's have a normal wedding. Let's do things the way they should be. There can be instances where she says, what he did to me was very unkind and unfair, but I still want to marry him. Sure, there can be instances. The Torah says that because he pained her, he can never divorce her again. Okay.
So
when...
But if you do it, then you could just can rape somebody and pay a fine and...
First of all, the act is prohibited.
Yeah.
That no one's saying you're allowed to hurt someone else or violate someone else.
The
issue is that aside from paying for her pain and aside from paying for what he's done to her, there's a set tax which he pays and a punishment that if she wants to lock him in, she can say, I want to marry him, and he must marry her, and he's never allowed to divorce her. That's her right, that she can now lock him in if she wants to.
Someone finds them in the act, he could kill the guy to stop.
Yeah.
That's if she was married.
Oh, it's only if she was married.
Yeah. If she's not married, cut off his leg, cut off his nose, chop off his ear, you know, do other things. Okay, Torah tells us there are different types of wounds that a person can have in the male organ, and the Torah prohibits a person from marrying once he has those wounds. One is that their male gonads have been crushed. And you'd be surprised, this comes up more than you'd expect, because not because people have fatal accidents where their gonads are crushed, but because there is something which plagues 20% of the population called varicocele, which is... Verico means vein, cell means large, Latin. So 20% of the population have an enlarged vein near their male gonad. So very often it can go on and it doesn't bother a person. But sometimes, and this isn't uncommon, the heat of having this enlarged vein next to the male gonad causes the male gonad over time to disintegrate. And a person, it's been known to happen, that a guy wakes up one morning and discovered he has no gonad on one side. So there we have a halachic discussion. Is that called krut shavchach? Is that identical? It doesn't happen in a day. It happens over years. But people have woken up in the morning, and this is a shaila I've gotten, where a person wakes up one day and says, hey, I'm missing one. It's gone, right?
It was 20% like in those times, right?
No, today. Varicocele scientifically affects 20% of the population today.
But
I'm not saying
20%. Heard about this?
Okay. Yes. Yeah. It can affect a person's fertility,
like,
but again, most people have children and they're fine with it. I mean, most people, even if they have varicocele, they're fine. The army, most people discovered when they enlisted the army, because one of the things the army checks for is that. And then they offer you a free surgery to fix it. Not sure I would recommend it, but they do offer it to you. Back to our parasha. So another ailment that can affect a person is if the male organ was slit. That's called krut shafcha. The organ that spills out his semen and his urine has a slit in it, and that's a person who, when he goes to the bathroom, it dribbles. Meaning, instead of coming straight out of the urethra, there's a slit, and it just drips down on the floor instead. And that's why the halacha says, if you're using a bathroom, you shouldn't leave a little puddle where you were. You don't want people thinking that you're... I guess this was common in Chazal's time. Today, we rarely hear about it. In Chazal's time, this must have been common. We're moving forward.
And in these cases, like, these people can't get married?
No, they can get married, but not to every Jew. They have to get married to people who are not called Kahal Hashem. That means that there are levels of Yichus, there are levels, you have a Kohen, you have a Levi. So within that, there's a breaking point where it's still called Kehal Hashem. Mm-hmm. And anyone who's in that breaking point, they can't marry. Other people, they can marry. In the Gemara's time, they knew how to fix the slit. A Krut Shavcha was fixable in the days of Talmud.
They castration sometimes.
Okay. We have a mamzer. What's a mamzer? That's a person that's born from an illicit relationship that is punishable with kares. So there are some relationships the Torah says don't do it, and then some relationships the Torah says don't do it, and if you do it, you get cut off from the world to come. For example, marrying a married woman. The woman thinks her husband died at war, she doesn't have a kosher divorce, she gets remarried, 20 years later her husband walks in, all her children are mamzer. All the children she had from the second husband, she was technically married to the first guy. She committed adultery all these years. All her children are mamzer. A guy marries his sister. A guy marries his sister-in-law. Meaning we have a mitzvah. If a person dies without children, then his brother has a mitzvah to marry the widow, the sister-in-law. In Russia, there were people who got confused. Whenever the brother would die, there were communities where they thought it was a mitzvah to marry the sister, even if she had two kids. Well, if you did that, then the next children would be a mamzer. The children who come from the second marriage are mamzerim. They're bastards. They've been spiritually tainted. So you'll ask me, what'd the kid do wrong? And I'll say, what does the kid do wrong when his mother smokes crack or drinks alcohol in pregnancy? The kid did nothing wrong, but the mother made him into a wounded person, right? He's going to be born with defects. He didn't do anything. It was his mother that did something. So the same is true here. This is a spiritual defect that the parents can inflict on a child.
It's a child that's born with out of wedlock?
Then he's just not considered that he was given the best gifts spiritually, but he's kosher. He can marry a regular. He can marry regularly. So that was a big discussion between, right? So again, the Talmud says if a man is intimate with his wife when she didn't purify herself from nida, so then the children that are born are more prone to being brazen people, but they're kosher to marry a regular Jew. And brazen people who don't have shame like other people, because the father didn't have shame. He was, but Rabbi Feinstein says sometimes you meet a girl or a boy, and they're very nice people, and you know that their mother did not go to mikvah. You know that the woman was, they didn't have a mikvah in her town. You know, she wasn't observant. It didn't exist by her. So Rabbi Feinstein says, then you'll have to assume that she went to the local pool, which happened to have been a kosher mikvah. There can be instances. In Russia, they did this. They would begin filling the pool with rainwater. They would make the local pool into a kosher mikvah. Now, it's more complicated than that, because a filter can disqualify a pool. But you'll have to assume that she once went to bathe in the river. You know, I took my kids to the Kinneret 2 weeks ago. So in the middle of swimming in the Kinneret, I said, guys, give me 2 minutes. I swam into the deep end, and I dunked, because I don't get to go to the mikvah often. I said, let me dunk mikvah dunking, right? So Rav Feinstein says, you'll have to assume that before she was intimate with her husband, she went swimming in a river, in a pond, in something that was a kosher mikvah, and that's how she became pure, because you see, the kid doesn't have, that he's not tainted the way Chazal say he would be. So we don't know how to factor these things out.
David did that with the Givonim, right?
Thursday night. Let's move on. Ammon and Moab are prohibited from marrying into Israel because they didn't greet us with bread and water. They boycotted us. So from here we learn how we view BDS, right? For generations we will not marry into Ammon and Moab because they boycotted us. Baseless hatred. We're talking about even if they convert. If the Ammonites and Moabites convert, we say marry within yourselves. Don't marry us.
You can't even... Is it third generation?
No. Tenth generation. Doesn't matter. They can never marry into us. They can convert, but they'll have to marry within other people, not with us. Ten generations later, it's irrelevant. Okay, so the rabbis always retain the yichus. Rabbis know. No, no. Yeah. Okay. This also teaches us about what's called Achnasas Archim. You know, a person's hungry. You know, they're thirsty. Greet them with food and water. This famous story about the Chafetz Chaim, who had a guest who had come from a long journey. This is it'll blow you away, the story. I'm not saying you should do like this story. You have to know all the details, but just the concept teaches us a lot. The Chafetz Chaim had a guest who had come from a long journey. He was hungry. He was thirsty. He was tired. So the guy comes to the Chafetz Chaim's house and he makes kiddush right away. So the guy looks at the Chafetz Chaim and he says, "Shalom aleichem, eish yischayel." So the Chafetz Chaim says, "Later." So they sit down, they eat, and after they've eaten and they've drank, so the Chafetz Chaim starts saying Shalom Aleichem and Eish Yischayel. So they ask the Chafetz Chaim, "What's going on?" The Chafetz Chaim says, "This man is hungry. This man is thirsty. He just came from a long journey. It's a nice custom to sing Shalom Aleichem. It's a nice custom to sing Eish Yischayel. But not when there's a Jew that's standing here hungry and thirsty. Feed him and give him to drink, and then we'll sing Shalom Aleichem and Eish Yischayel." The story goes that the next morning, the Chafetz Chaim went to daven bright and early ordinarily. He didn't that morning. He waited, let the guest sleep, and then went to a late minyan with the guest. So the guest said, "I thought I would daven in your shul with you." And he said, "So we'll daven together in a different shul. You were tired. You came from a long journey. I could see you were tired. So I'm going to wake you to daven at my minyan." Again, the idea of what it means to be kind to a guest. We move on. Torah says, when you think about Hitler, remember that he took you into the land and he gave you a place to live. Okay, the Torah is not talking about Hitler, but it teaches us a concept. Torah says, Edom, remember they're your relatives. Mitzrayim, remember they took you in when you needed a place to live. They took us in. They murdered our children. They tortured us. What didn't they do to us? Right? But there were good things they did to you too. Don't forget that. So that means when we speak about Germany, there's an aspect where we say we remember the evil they did to us. There's an aspect we say they did take in Jews and give them a livelihood. It's a tough balancing act.
Don't you have those three rabbis talking about Rome?
Okay.
And one of them was just, he didn't mention anything good about Rome. He said they're building bridges for themselves and they're
You're asking a great question. You're 100% right. Good question. We move on. Why don't you bring a proof to what I said from the other two rabbis? We move on.
I don't like what they say.
Instead of being thankful, it's like almost saying, "Oh, I invited someone to my house, let them stay there, and then I gave them food a little bit, and then I decided to tie them up and torture them."
Right.
It's kind of like a weird.
Right. It's an interesting concept. We would ordinarily say, let's only remember the bad, and the Torah says you have to remember the good too.
But it wasn't like that fast. There were many generations where Jews were very welcome in Germany.
Right.
For example. And then,
we move on. We have in my family a yad that's used to point in the Sefer Torah that has a dedication in memory of the Jewish soldiers who died fighting for Germany in World War I. Those wonderful, faithful citizens. They were proud. The shul.
The Germans, friends, Jews fought each other. But they prayed mainly together.
Yeah.
They killed each other.
We move on. Torah says when you go to war, be very careful. Those of you who plan enlisting in the army, so Torah says you have to be careful of evil things. What are evil things? We're not supposed to talk immodestly. We're not supposed to have immodest things in the camp. We're not supposed to talk lashon hara about one another. You have to be extra careful to have unity when you're going to war. Torah says your people are going to do their bodily needs, they should have a shovel. They should bury it. And you shouldn't have immodesty in the camp. So, when we were fighting the Yom Kippur War, they could see in their binoculars there were busloads of women of ill repute being bussed in for the Egyptian soldiers. They would literally have buses coming in all night for the Egyptian soldiers. And this is a common thing. Torah says, when you go to war, you have to be the most pious. You're not allowed to even reveal yourself in the camp. We view our camp of soldiers as the camp of God. Hashem is walking in your camp. From the concept of an army, we learn the laws of modesty. The Torah says, no immodest part should be revealed, because your camp is holy. From there we learn. You want to learn Torah, and there's a woman on the bus wearing shorts, you can't see her while you're talking Torah. You can't make a blessing on a food. You can't pray when you see something immodest. If the pants go beyond the knee, fine. If what's above the knee is revealed, I'm not allowed to talk Torah. I can turn away. If I don't see it, I could talk Torah. I could close my eyes. If I don't see it, I can make a blessing or pray. But if I see it, I can't. The Torah teaches us this specifically about the place where people tend to be most vulgar. You're going to war. Your life is on the line. You know, you guys know what the army looks like. All the dirty jokes are clean in the army because there's worse. All the dirty language is clean in the army because there's worse. No, Torah says the army and your camp is the place of holiness. And from there we derive laws of holiness to our own shul, to our own home. That's the Torah's description of a Jewish camp. A Jewish camp has to be a place of holiness. Hashem says, I'm coming with you, right? I'm going to save you from the enemy. Keep the camp holy. From here we learn that when there's feces revealed, you're not allowed to talk Torah. So where do you run into this? When you have kids, right? You're toilet training the kid, and suddenly you see the kid gets a serious look on their face, and you know, that's it. Boom. No making Kiddush now, right? Got to clean up. And you can't make Kiddush when there's the kid had an accident there, right? There's urine on the floor, there's something else on the floor, right? So no talking Torah, no making blessings. Before I make Kiddush or I bench at home, we check the kid's diaper. I'm not supposed to sit next to a dirty diaper and say God's name, talk Divrei Torah. So we have this ritual, right? Just before Kiddush, everyone's gathered around the table. We check if he's developed a new surprise for us, right? So that's this law. That has to be covered, it has to be buried. You're not supposed to talk holy things next to human feces or human excrement. Yes?
Yes, Rav. With regard to the woman dressed immodest, making a blessing, it says in front of a woman who dressed immodest. But it says in front. What if she's in front of me, and I'm behind her?
The key is, do you see her or don't you see her?
Okay.
And that's why when I say kiddush at home, I always hold a bencher in front of my face. This way my kids won't notice that I'm doing it because there's a woman who's a guest at her house and her hair is uncovered or her sleeves go up above her elbow or for whatever reason. Or that's how I always do kiddush. So I try to always do kiddush either with my eyes closed or with a bencher held up. That way they don't notice the difference when I'm doing it to cover for someone else.
So isn't that, can't you do that in the same situation when you have your son with
no.
a dirty diaper or something?
With feces it doesn't work. It works with something immodest. There the Torah says you shouldn't see it. But with feces, the question is it uncovered? Can you smell it? Is it accessible? Is it here?
And what if you see a woman who's very attractive and you're like you're looking at her face, like her face is very attractive. Is there anything bad about that?
So a number of things. On the level of, am I allowed to talk holiness? I'm allowed to. Because the key here is, are parts of her that should be covered uncovered or not? That's the definition. If she's dressed modestly, she's just beautiful, you're allowed to make blessings next to beautiful people. That's not a problem. On the other hand, the halacha does say that you're not supposed to take in a woman's beauty unless she's your wife. Because the Talmud says, even looking at her pinky, if you're looking at it because it's something that you want to take in, the beauty, so that's wrong. But that's a different halacha. That's,
Yeah, but what if you're not married? You look at her and you want to marry her. I mean, you look at her for the possibility and you're maybe marrying her.
On the fifth date, that makes sense.
No,
on the seventh date,
like stranger walking by.
You're going to marry any stranger?
No,
why don't you first find out who she is?
No, he's talking about like on a date or something.
No.
Why isn't?
No. Then you find out. Then you want to find out who she is.
Our assumption is work the other way around. Start by finding a person of value who you believe you can marry. And then on the fifth or sixth date, you'll take a peek and see if her looks satisfy you. Start the other way. Because otherwise, I'm saying you should be looking all day and all night, right? Yeah. It's a bad excuse. Eov says, Job, Brit karati leinai. I made a covenant with my eyes. Uvalet bonen al betula. I don't even look at a virgin who I might marry. because you know you might not marry all the good-looking girls you see. It might happen that way, right? So even in Job's days, when he could marry multiple wives, he says, "But there could be a girl that catches my fancy, and I won't marry her, right?" Yeah. And then what's going to be? I'm going to walk around thinking about her beauty. So that's what Eov describes. And the truth is, it's good advice, but it happens to be a hard habit. Yeah. It's a habit to develop. Yeah. I'm saying our nature is that we look at people as they walk by, and if they're good looking, we continue looking. Yeah. A person has to get into the habit not to look and to veer his eyes away.
What is that? Modest is over the elbows, over the knees, right?
Modest is not only that. The parts of the body that have to be covered are above the bones, yeah, the collarbone, the elbows, and the knee.
What about like, but, like this neighborhood?
Wait. But it depends on, you know, a person can wear clothing that's so tight. Technically, everything's covered, yeah? They have a sleeve coming down to here, but you could see every movement of their body. That's not modest. Modesty is not only about what's covered.
Yes.
Neighborhoods like this, you know, like we, you know, like the black Hillary people, like, you see, like, people, the women wear, their hair is covered, and then, you know, she's wearing, and she's wearing a skirt that, like, maybe, like it doesn't go over the knees, you know, or, like, her shirt goes, like, the hair, you know, I see it a lot, you know, like, okay. Is that, are they going against Sabaka, though, or, like, you know, like,
look, we our job isn't to judge other people. Our job is to develop ourselves. I'm just not answering. I'm saying I think in general we shouldn't be looking at whether other people are adhering to halacha. If you're dating a girl and you're wondering, is she modest enough? Is it right? What? Saying, I'll tell you a story, okay? I'll end with a story. We're out of time, so I'll end with a story. There was a big rabbi who was sitting Shiva, and many rabbis came to visit him. And as he's sitting Shiva, so all these long bearded rabbis are sitting around, and a woman walks into the room and says, "Rabbi, may Hashem comfort you." And she says, "Amakom yenachem otcha," and "Thank you for all your help," and she walks out. But when she walked in, everyone started squirming in their seats uncomfortably because she walked in with a leather suit that was skin tight. Like, it was as though she wasn't wearing anything. It was the tightest leather suit you can imagine. She walks into the room on her high heels and she's comforting the rabbi. And the other rabbis, like, they put their head down and they're like, right? So after she leaves the building, so the rabbi who's sitting Shiva commented, he said, "You should know there walks one of the more pious people I've ever met in my life." So everyone's jaw dropped, like, "Huh? Why is he saying that?" So, in confidence, he told me, he said to me, "You know who that lady was?" I said, "No, I have no idea. I wasn't even there when it happened." He says to me, "That's a woman who got married to a man in medical school. And when he was in medical school, so a doctor has to spend a lot of time in the hospital and sometimes Shabbos. So they had an apartment in the city next to the hospital where he was training. And on those Shabbatot, where he'd have to be in the hospital, she would come into the city and they'd spend Shabbos there in that apartment. Well, they had a child. And they continued doing this. And then the child became 6-7 years old. And he became more and more obligated to the hospital. And it turned out that 2 out of 3 weeks they were spending in the city in that apartment. And when the kid came of age, so she said to her husband, "You know, it's very good that you're in the hospital and I value what you're doing. But who's going to take our little boy to shul? Who's going to ensure that he knows how to daven?" And so she said to her husband, "I think that the weeks you have to be in the hospital, I have to go to my parents so that the boy learns what davening and shul is." So he said to me, "Look at this lady. She doesn't know a lot about Judaism. But what she does know is that a little boy has to daven and shul on Shabbos. So for the things she knows, she was willing to give up her weekend with her husband. She gave up one of the most precious things in a person's life. Having time on the weekend with your husband," she said, "but we have to educate the kid to be a good Jew. So from what she understands what a good Jew is, she's willing to do everything for it. So what are you going to say? She's not dressed modestly? She never learned that. No one ever told her that. You see that the things she learns, she observes all the way with tremendous dedication. So what are you saying? She didn't yet learn that, so she's not observing that. So, but in Shamayim, they look at her and they say, look at this person. The mitzvos, they know, they're willing to do everything for those mitzvos. Isn't that a tzaddik?